But there are times when you want to listen and evoke and discover people's reasons and how might you go about that? What would you hope? Who can help you be successful? Where you move towards asking more open-ended questions to draw solutions out from people in much more of a non-judgmental way. Positive psychology has done is brought science to this area and domain. So we understand some of the interventions which can help people thrive and flourish. We understand why people in different countries may experience a higher quality of life and life satisfaction, despite not necessarily having more material wealth.
Welcome to BLA Connections, A Clear Voice. I am your host, Natalie Watson, and I'm delighted to bring you discussions and insights from experts from across the globe on all things laryngology and beyond. In today's episode, we welcome Dr. Tim Anstis, trainer of health and wellbeing coaching and a behaviour change specialist. He works with NHS trusts, local authorities, health charities, sports organisations, and across a whole range of companies and organisations. He is also the medical advisor for Rugby Players Association, and he has been involved in a number of international behaviour change initiatives. In his younger years, he pole vaulted for Great Britain and was a contestant on Gladiators. Currently also a public speaker, and most recently became a lecturer at the Henley Business School. Thank you so much, Dr. Tim Anstis, for joining us today.
I've been looking forward to it, Natalie. Thanks for inviting me along.
Oh, fabulous. Well, let's kick off. I wondered if you could give us just a brief overview of your career and experience to date.
Super. So I studied medicine at Southampton, and in the middle of your course, after your third year, you had an elective, and I went to the University of Virginia, which was lovely, and they ran a master's in sports medicine. So then I came back, did another year in med school, went out and did a 1 year in sports medicine at the University of Virginia, and that I found that quite transformational because I dropped stats and physiology because I'd already done that, and I had to take two kind of night school classes, and I did health education, philosophy and ethics and health behaviour, and I suddenly realised this kind of world outside medicine around behaviour change and what used to be called compliance, and realised that that was really a big interest. So then came back, did my house jobs, started a rotational training scheme in psychiatry, which was great. We got some training in behaviour therapy and cognitive behaviour therapy that was a bit unusual, and got a diploma in occupational medicine and kind of found a clinical home for 10 years, running an occupational health service for both Ealing Hospital and the West London Healthcare Trust, but managed to get my hands on a gym and set up a fitness centre for staff before work, lunchtime and evenings. Got a small grant for cardiac rehab and won a little bit of work for a sub-regional chronic pain service. So I was able to get into kind of behavioural medicine and lifestyle change in the NHS. So it's hard to earn a living as a preventative medicine, especially if you don't want to do public health. So fortunately managed to carve out a bit of space for myself as an occupational health doctor running a gym, which was nice. I set up an MSc at Thames Valley University, now University of West London, which was nice, an MSc in exercise and behavioural medicine. So developed that for a few years, which was nice. And then got involved in consulting. A friend of mine, Melvin Hilsen, who'd been a director for Living Well Fitness, came to work at Ealing, and he was approached by someone for a consultancy in South London, and got involved in a quite innovative project in Peckham, where they had £5 million for a new build leisure centre as part of a massive regeneration scheme in South London. And I kind of said, I kind of acted as an advisor, don't build just a replacement leisure centre. Look at the pre-war Peckham Pioneer Health Centre, which was very innovative. We may post a link if we can, a fascinating experiment in South London pre-war, which was a true family wellbeing centre. They wanted to create the right conditions for health to emerge. It never made its way into the NHS, but they talked about a true health centre. And at the time, I was very interested in the medical fitness movement in the States, where lots of hospitals were owning health clubs and for employees as well. and that became the Peck and Pulse, which was an early healthy living centre. And in parallel to that, I'd heard about this approach called motivational interviewing and got trained in it as a trainer quite early. And a big chunk of my career over the last 20 years really has been training up clinicians and doctors and nurses and others in motivational interviewing and health coaching, which has now become, you know, almost mainstream. If you look at what's happening with the NHS, with personalized care and patient activation and shared decision making, and, you know, the phrase, you know, don't talk about what's the matter with me, talk about what matters to me. You know, motivational interviewing is just a lovely way to make this transition towards a more person-centered, activating, empowering type conversation. So that's, I've done a few other things, well, lecturing at Henley Business School on their coaching MSc. So always had a bit of a portfolio career, which has its rewards. But of course, if you are independent, you know, if you don't work, you don't get paid.
Brilliant. What a varied career. It's actually fantastic and fascinating to hear your career story. So thank you very much for sharing. So you mentioned about your coaching. I wondered whether we could ask about your coaching approach. It's termed integrated health and well-being. Can you just explain what that is and what the steps are involved?
I'm very interested in well-being and happiness and flourishing and psychological health as something positive above and beyond the absence of mental illness. And there's been the emergence of a legitimate scientific domain, a psychological domain of positive psychology, being given a kickstart by Seligman and others. So it's really, how do we best go about having a conversation with someone in a way which might increase the chances that they take steps to protect and improve their health and well-being? So obviously there's a handful of behavioural risk factors which explain quite a lot of the variance in long-term conditions. So we know physical activity, diet, smoking, alcohol, stress, sleep, you know, medication taking. So there's a handful of behavioural risk factors, which if people could change, could make a big difference to the probability of them developing a condition, but also if they have a condition, reduce the chances they develop complications. And with some conditions, you know, could arrest or even reverse development. But also kind of well-being coaching, we know, can help people become less depressed and less anxious. If we imagine mental health and mental illness on a continuum, with mental illness at one end, and then thriving, flourishing, living your best life at the other, what we know is there's a significant number of people who are free from mental illness, may be considered a term used by Corey Keyes to be languishing, just not really living their best life. You know, life's a bit meh, you know, frustrated, disappointed, poor quality of life. So how can we help that group of people move towards thriving and flourishing, having more happiness and well-being? And I tend to coach people using Seligman articulated 5 pillars of well-being. So he saw well-being as thriving and flourishing as related to, he calls his model PERMA, relatively frequent positive emotions. E, good engagement in life, which is like the state of flow where you get lost in an activity. R is relationships, positive relationships we know are so important for mental health and well-being. M is meaning and purpose, and A, a feeling of achievement and accomplishment. So sometimes I coach with people and we look at options and things they're doing to strengthen each of those pillars. And then just in terms of the continuum, the other side of languishing, but before you become, we have mental illness, some people experience burnout. And we know that is kind of endemic, or, you know, in healthcare system, in people who work in healthcare systems. And it's viewed very much as an organizational phenomenon. So it's important not to think that people who are burned out are in any way weak or lacking resilience, because it's something about the way we organize and deliver healthcare, which kind of is driving this epidemic of burnout in compassionate, intelligent, motivated individuals. And it's a tragedy, really.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been lots of talk about burnout recently. There's been talk from the BMA about burnout. People are worried at work that they're going to be burning out, especially if we've got a third wave coming. Is there a particular point in a person's career when they turn to coaching?
I don't know. I think coaching, back in the day, might have been frowned upon as a kind of, you know, a bit of new age, fluffy, a bit lightweight. But certainly coaching has really come on now. There's much more evidence based around coaching. There's much more professional development for coaching. And also you need to make a distinction perhaps between people who realize that coaching is part of their day job, like many nurses and OTs and physios and speech and language therapists as well. They realize that behavior change is part of their day job, and then people who might be full-time coaches. I think coaching can be sometimes seen as more acceptable for some people than having psychotherapy and counseling, even though you may, you know, there is cognitive behavioral coaching. So when do people turn to coaching? I mean, some of it is if they're just underperforming in life or they're dissatisfied with life. Obviously, you know, sports people come to coaching for improved performance in sports. I think, you know, a lot of people can experience frustration and difficulty and struggle because that's the nature of existence, but they realize they may not necessarily want, you know, psychotherapy or counseling. But as I say, there is a big overlap between these things. And essentially, there is a saying sometimes that, you know, psychotherapy tends to look backwards and coaching tends to be looking forwards. I'm not sure that's necessarily correct.
Well, so it's really interesting. And listening to what you were saying about flourishing, it's that word has been bounced about quite a lot recently. And I have a number of friends who've started to be flourishing coaches or, you know, coaches.
Oh, really?
Who are, yeah. So it's quite interesting you use the term flourishing. It's really a hot topic now with us coming out of the second wave of COVID and trying to really, you know, knuckle down and improve ourselves.
So in well-being, we sometimes make a distinction between subjective well-being, which is like the feeling, how do you feel? And then what is also called sometimes thriving and flourishing, which is more about doing well. And the Greek term for that particular state, living your best life, was eudaimonia. So it is the case that within positive psychology, this field of human thriving and flourishing and optimum human development, we make a distinction between subjective well-being, how you feel inside, but also, as you've said, thriving and flourishing. And what positive psychology has done is brought science to this area and domain. So we understand some of the interventions which can help people thrive and flourish. We understand why people in different countries may experience a higher quality of life and life satisfaction, despite not necessarily having more material wealth. So, which is lovely. We're now actually having a much better understanding of the determinants of a good life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I saw a post on Twitter or Facebook the other day about all the natural endorphins, how you can achieve those by just natural, like holding a baby or having a run or eating good food or something like that. It's just absolutely brilliant. That we have some science behind it all.
And there's an emerging and rapidly spreading approach to psychotherapy and well-being called compassion-focused therapy and compassionate mind training, pioneered by Professor Paul Gilbert at Derby. And it's really about helping people sometimes activate self-compassion and the compassionate pathways in their brain. So compassion is built on the mammalian caring pathways. And one definition of compassion is sensitivity to suffering in self and others with a commitment to alleviate suffering. And so a lot of healthcare professionals are compassionate. Lots of human beings are compassionate. But there's three flows of compassion. So there's compassion that may flow from you to someone else when you notice their suffering. Then there's compassion that may flow from someone else to you if someone notices your suffering. And the third flow of compassion is from yourself to yourself, and we call that self-compassion. And some people can really struggle with that. They talk to themselves in a way that they would never talk with anybody else. So people can have quite a harsh inner critic. And in healthcare as well, a harsh inner critic combined with perfectionist tendencies, that can drive poor well-being as well, feelings of guilt and shame, and indeed burnout. So one of the things I'm particularly interested in, how do we work with an individual to help them, first of all, get an understanding of what compassion is, because sometimes they think it's just a feeling or it's the same as pity, whereas actually it's much more of a a motivational state, quite a complex thing. And then how can they activate the compassionate parts of their brain, including treating themselves with the same non-judgment, care, and kindness and warmth that they might treat someone else. And I think that's got massive potential for improving well-being, including at the population level.
Absolutely fascinating. So, right, what we're going to do now is we're going to go back to that question. This is really asking about when would I turn to coaching or when would my colleagues turn to coaching?
I think it's important to recognise that you're probably already coaching, Natalie. The way you talk with people, you know, there's times as a clinician where it's best to diagnose, instruct, tell, you know, where you need to be instructional and telling. But there are times when you want to listen and evoke and discover people's reasons and how might you go about that? What would you hope? Who can help you be successful? Where you move towards asking more open-ended questions to draw solutions out from people in much more of a non-judgmental way. So I think I certainly, as an occupational health doctor, was seeing people and using cognitive behavior therapy, but I was also suggesting maybe they meditated, and I was suggesting maybe they read a little bit of Epictetus, a Stoic philosopher, or a bit of Buddhism. And I realized I wasn't really doing CBT. I wasn't really doing therapy. And then I became aware of the fact that I was probably coaching. So I think there's recognizing that a chunk of what you do as a healthcare professional can be coaching, and you may want to get better at it. But then there's deciding that actually you want to become a coach and maybe going to get a qualification and then sitting down with people and doing coaching, as opposed to just realizing that coaching is an important part of your day job.
Yeah.
And it is very rewarding. And there's an overlap with coaching and mentoring. So many clinicians, as they move up the hierarchy, realize that working with others in a coaching style and coaching and supporting and mentoring others is good for the department, good for the service, good for them, good for their colleagues. So you've also got that overlap between, you know, a coaching mentoring style in the way you work with colleagues. And then there's this recognition that actually this is something I can get better at with training and deliberate practice.
Yeah. There's a number of courses that are being run. There's one by Women in ENT, but for everybody on mentoring and coaching, and that's coming up soon. So if you want to sign up to that, we'll put the link in the show notes.
Excellent.
So you also work with teams, big teams and organisations, as well as the NHS. And how difficult is it to really bring change within a team and kind of organisations' work culture? Because every hospital that you go to, every team within a hospital is very different. I always find the culture is really set out by kind of the people at the top. So how do you influence them?
It's in motivational interviewing, one of the core concepts is ambivalence. People have mixed feelings about change. And I think organizations also have mixed feelings about change. They may see the advantages of change and the disadvantages, and the advantages of staying the same and the disadvantages. So there's not rushing in and telling, because that can trigger defensiveness and reactance. There's helping people think through the pros and cons of change. And of course, there are so many different approaches to change as well. What I heard about and then started to practice, and then was fortunate enough, we got a grant from the Social Partnership for London, and we ran a 12-month kind of action learning set with 7 NHS trusts, is an approach called appreciative inquiry. Which is one way of doing appreciative inquiry is called the 4D cycle. So first of all, you discover what you're going to inquire about. So it could be, how do we build a better culture? Or how do we reach our potential as a department? Or how do we manage the transition to a new building whilst maintaining good services? So you decide what it is you want to inquire about. And this is a very conversational, democratic, participatory approach to organizational change. It's a positive organizational development methodology. The first phase is discover. You discover what's working. You discover what you're good at. This happens in conversation. So you prepare a bit of paperwork and you set people up in teams and they interview each other. So you and I might interview each other. I'll have a bit of paper. I'll say, Natalie, what is it you like about working here? And tell me about some of the things you think we do well. You know, what are we good at? And tell me, Natalie, what are some of the things you'd like to see more of in the future? And then you'd interview me using the same questions. And then we may get back together in a group of six or eight. I've done it live with tables. I haven't yet done it on Zoom with rooms, but I'm looking forward to doing it in Zoom with rooms. And I'd say, well, I interviewed Natalie. Natalie said that some of the things we do well as a department or a service are X, Y, and Z. And she gave me a lovely example where we came together and we did this. Some of the things she'd like to see more of in the future, PQ&W, et cetera. And then you'd say, and I interviewed Tim. And so what you hear is all these stories about discovering what's the best of us. What are we good at? What are our values? And that's the D phase. And it's not just that it generates, you know, some things to write on a flip chart. It's actually a nice process of discovery and building trust and understanding other people in the team and department. Because sometimes in group meetings, as you know, some people dominate, some people are silent. So you're really giving people an opportunity to be heard. The next D is called dream. And the question is pretty much, we imagine we're a year and a half from now, and we've developed a world-class reputation for our work, and people really want to come to work here, and we're doing good research. Tell me, how will things be different? What will be going on? And then you'd say, and how will we have got there? What will have happened along the way to enable us to get there? And then the next question might be, and how will you have contributed? And then I'd interview you, you'd interview me, and then we'd share. And so within half a day, typically, you can do the discover phase and the dream phase, and it's very rich and generative. And the problem with strategy isn't its creation. The problem with strategy is its implementation. And what I like about appreciative inquiry is it's very participative, and the people who are going to have to implement the strategy have come up with it. So because the people who have participated in the appreciative inquiry event will have said, well, in order to have got there, we need to have done this. We need to have sorted this. I think also we need to have done this. The actual strategy is created in a very bottom-up way by the people who are going to have to implement it. And then the next D is, could we design and deliver in terms of how are you going to implement it? And depending on which author you read, the Americans tend to use destiny as the fourth D, but I find that a little bit too fluffy. So maybe design and deliver. So appreciative inquiry, I really like as a methodology. There's another approach to bringing about change in organizations developed by Kotter. And spookily enough, just last week, an ebook updated was made available, and we can post a link to it, around these eight stages of change. And I could potentially embarrass myself by trying to remember them. But it's something like form a guiding coalition, create a shared vision, then there's communicate the vision for buy-in, enable people to act on the vision. And so sometimes we rush in and we try to enable people to act rather than working upstream, creating a guiding coalition, not necessarily all the usual leaders, and creating a shared vision. So again, sometimes change initiatives peter out in a way due to a lack of energy and momentum. And we know this from all the quality improvement initiatives. So I do some quality improvement training and coaching for a hospital over in the east of London. And you have people coming up and they've got to do a quality improvement initiative. And often they're trying to drive it through on their own. And there's no team. They haven't got system leadership, day-to-day leadership. They're not using the right tools and methods. And it must be so frustrating. You know, there is a science of organizational change and development. There is a science of positive development. I tend to share stuff. I just read widely. And I like to think one of the things I do is just signpost people to the stuff that's probably going to work to save them some time and effort. You know, if you're trying to do that, you might find this helpful, because you and I know there's a lot of people running around just using non-theory driven, non-evidence-based approaches to change, and unfortunately often making things worse.
Trying to reinvent the wheel when there's already a whole pathway to follow.
Yeah.
But that's really kind to share all that information. So we'll be looking forward to reading all of those in the show notes later. So probably the most important and final question is that it has been a very tough year for a lot of people, and working in healthcare, obviously mental health and wellbeing has been severely impacted and affected. What have you experienced with your clients this year, and what can we do to safeguard our wellbeing exiting the pandemic and for the future? I mean, you've mentioned quite a number of things about building teams and helping, the number of things that you do, the risk factors. But what can we do for ourselves?
I think there's been a big and understandable emphasis on well-being at work, and you've had Schwartz rounds, and there's been, you know, much more counselling available, etc. So there's been quite a few organisational changes in an attempt to build better workplaces for people and be responsive to the immense amount of suffering that's been experienced during the pandemic. In terms of what individuals can do, I can share with you some of the worksheets I use. I do commonly share with people a five pillars worksheet where I say, look, here's a range of things you might do to experience more frequent positive emotions. You know, the what went well exercise, cultivating gratitude, increasing contact with nature, reconnecting with friends, getting in the flow, becoming more active. And here's a range of things you might do to have more engagement in life. You know, finding a hobby, repairing something, getting back into a sport, or, and then here are some things you might do around positive relationships, connecting with people, learning to listen better, something called active constructive responding, and maybe spending less time with people who might erode your well-being. And then under meaning, there's a range of things you might do. So I share with people options in a coaching way, saying, what are you doing already? And which of these might you want to experiment with? And sometimes I encourage people to actually, you know, measure their well-being. The science of well-being has been emerging. So we've got much more better understanding of psychopathology and how to measure anxiety and depression and addiction and eating disorders than we do well-being. But there are some nice measures of well-being. There's the World Health Organization five-item measure. There's the Warwick Edinburgh mental well-being scale. So you can also, you know, measure aspects of flourishing and happiness and well-being and see if those improve over time. Sometimes people do need to get away from a particular environment because some environments are toxic. The healthcare system is the only industry where if the canary dies, people say, bring me a stronger canary. You know, the fact that we've got so many healthcare professionals struggling does suggest that we need to redesign things. I'm also very taken, as I've mentioned, with this approach to self-compassion, because we've all got an inner dialogue. We all have self-talk going on inside our heads. And what is quite well established is harsh, condemning, shaming, aggressive self-talk from, let's say, an inner critic is strongly associated with a wide range of different poor mental health outcomes. So it's kind of transdiagnostic, associated with anxiety, addiction, self-harm, suicide, etc. But we also have an inner coach. So we also have perhaps a wise, compassionate self-part. We have multiple self-parts, and it can be worthwhile educating people about the fact that, well, we appear to have a unified self. Actually, it can be very helpful to think of ourselves as made up of self-parts. Changing your relationship with your critical self and learning skills to what in acceptance and commitment therapy we call defusion. So getting some distance from your thoughts, seeing your thoughts as things that come and go, not being so pushed around by your thoughts. That can be very helpful, as well as cultivating a compassionate other. And there's a sequence of exercises. And again, we'll post some links around cultivating feelings of safeness with soothing breathing rhythm. So slowing down the breathing rhythm to maybe 4 to 5 seconds on the out-breath with a one-second pause, and then 4 to 5 seconds on the in-breath, which may stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system. Doing some imagery and visualization about imagining yourself to be in a safe space, a place that welcomes you. And then starting to imagine that you're in the presence of a wise, compassionate other, and what that might feel like to be in the presence of a non-judgmental being, as it were. Because the mind is very powerful. If you're hungry and there's food, you will salivate. But if you're hungry and you just imagine food, you can salivate. If you're really aggressive with someone and get into an argument, you can feel angry and your physiology will change, your heart rate will speed up. But similarly, if you just imagine getting into an argument, that can change your physiology. And similarly, if you are being soothed and comforted for real by someone, that can calm and reassure you. So can cultivating and imagining being in the presence of a compassionate other can have the same physiological effect, which is the parasympathetic nervous system activating the rest and digest system. So I do have a course called Rebalance. I'll be running it again. But how do we make this stuff as accessible as possible? It's because not everybody wants to go and have compassion-focused therapy. So how can we make the kind of stuff I've been talking about just widely accessible? And I think some of that is going to be via kind of, you know, massive open online courses and really good websites and good audios and training up peer coaches so that we can look after ourselves better. And obviously, you know, perhaps like you, just really enthusiastic and passionate about the health and well-being of healthcare professionals.
Oh, that absolutely shines out of you. You can hear you're so passionate about this. It's so heartwarming to hear such passion and such kindness and compassion for all of us, and sharing all your views about and tips and tricks about coaching.
Yeah, you're making me blush now, Natalie.
Oh, no, it's been great. I've really enjoyed the podcast. It's been really, really great, and learning all the 4D cycle. I'd love to use that in our local laryngology team, so that's great. So are there any take-home messages that you have for our listeners?
Take-home messages. What I'd like to do is send some links to nice free content so people can, if they choose, engage with and immerse themselves in some of the things I've said. You just have to treat yourself with the same non-judgment warmth and kindness, hopefully, that you treat other people with. Because, you know, we probably only have one life, and our inner critic can reduce the quality of our life quite dramatically. So if you can find a way to soften your inner critic and cultivate your wise, compassionate inner coach, I think that's going to set you up for, you know, better well-being for many years into the future.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for sharing all your tips and tricks. We look forward to seeing all the show notes.
Sorry, now I'm just going to thank you for having me along, because it's just nice to get it all out and chat with someone about this stuff. So thank you.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming on. We hope you've enjoyed listening to BLA Connections, A Clear Voice. I've been your host, Natalie Watson. Please do tune in this series for more about well-being, exploring the patient experience and furthering our education with various laryngology topics. We would also love to hear from you. Please feel free to email with any topics you would like us to explore, any questions you have, along with any suggested experts you would like to hear from. Also, if you'd like to contribute to these podcasts, please email inquiries@britishlaryngological.org. Our full series can be found in the podcast provider of your choice, or you will find all stored on our BLA Connect app for easy access. Thank you to all our listeners, and we hope you found our podcast informative. Please remember to subscribe and do leave a review with your podcast provider. We do appreciate your likes, subscribes, and reviews.